Ahoy hoy, let's start the show.
For Thursday, June 25th, 2020, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. Here we go. Let's do this. It's the new bone broth.
And you're a fan.
It's awesome. Wow, that was different and pretty cool. And I fully admit, I had not listened to that before hitting the play button on SoundCloud. So thankfully, it was rated at least PG.
I mean,
no mention of boning and brothing, but that's a new intro theme composed by one of you out there, because we are putting still at the call out for new intros. We're revamping the show intro because it's been too long. Not only has it been too long since we've had a new show theme, but our show theme is too long at 45 seconds. So courtesy of Jinx, aka Black Powder Engine, that's the theme for this week. Came in at 11 seconds. Thank you so much, Black Powder Engine. You know what? It sounded a little bit like an outro, and that's not surprising because Black Powder Engine has made some great outros for us. We'll take those too. But if you want to make an intro theme for this show, just email me a link, normanatesta.com, post it on SoundCloud, and I will guarantee you we will play it. Try at least the once on a future episode. But hello, everybody. Good morning. Good morning to you, Jeremy Williams.
Good morning, Norman Chan. How are you?
Very tired. But what else is new?
Happy Father's Day to you.
Oh, that's right. That was a couple days ago. You know, does Father's Day really matter? Like, I think Father's Day is just a day for me to feel guilty about not doing enough as my wife in raising our child. That's all it does. Another father on the podcast this week. It's not Kishore. We got Will Smith. Will, how are you doing?
Happy belated Father's Day. Hello, thank you.
Happy Father's Day to you too.
Thank you. Happy Father's Day to both of you, gentlemen. Somebody posted on Twitter the other day that Mother's Day is like universally celebrated as, look at all these amazing sacrifices these women in our lives have made. And then Father's Day is like, hey, thanks for not fucking it up too bad, Dad. Yeah.
That's basically how I felt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a low bar, but we reached it. Congratulations, guys.
Yeah. I got to sleep in on Sunday, and I felt guilty about it anyway.
Norm, you and your wife gave my daughter a stuffed dog when you came back from a trip a few years ago, and it was her birthday on Father's Day as well. So we celebrated her birthday with a cake and presents, and then I also got a card. So that was nice.
Yeah. Very nice.
Did your son make you anything, Norm?
I mean, he pooed 3 times.
That's a big accomplishment. That's a big load for a kid his size.
He didn't do it in the bath, so that's something. Little victories.
You had bath poops?
I have not personally experienced them, but my parents, in taking care of the son, have on 2 occasions, I have been told.
Bath poops.
We never had a bath poop. She just clenched up right when she got in the tub every time. We were very lucky.
I got a couple cards here. I got this beautiful
handmade
from the daughter. She's an artist. And then
I love yours.
My son, this is a little teaser of how excited I've been about this little announcement called Squadrons.
Wow.
For the audio listeners, awesome. Jeremy is holding a piece of paper with Arial font on top that says, "You're our squadron leader." And then 2 blackout silhouettes of a TIE fighter and an X-Wing. It's like the bare bones.
That's a good card. Minimalism is to be encouraged.
Hey, I grew up with print shop, okay, like the dot matrix printer. This would have been high class artwork, and I fully appreciate it. It warmed my heart.
I think that was more of a telegraph, a hint. Hey, Dad, you know, for you to be our squadron leader, you got to have a co-pilot. You got to have a wingman.
Oh, I'm all about that. I'm
telling
him
40 bucks.
I'm telling him to step up. I'm worried about you. You're so concerned that they're letting us turn, you know, y'all.
Oh no, you misread my tweet. What? I was excited. I want the more axes is better. We're gonna talk about some yaw. But yaw is not something you always get in flight sims, because not all joysticks and flight sticks have the yaw Axis, and I have a yaw axis joystick, and so any game that makes me let me rotate to turn the rudder, space rudder,
yes,
I'm all for that.
Excellent. Yeah. Okay, good.
So, I want to do like Battlestar Galactica, new Battlestar Galactica style skids. Like I want to turn off the engines, rotate, start shooting at people behind me, and then thrust out of that turn.
You know, that's what they're designed for. But we're getting way ahead of ourselves. We are getting way, way ahead of ourselves. We got to start the podcast with our catch up. We had Bill Duran on last week. Will, you're on this week. What's new with you?
I've been streaming video games, and I've been working on some pitches that I can't talk about. But I have been working on something else that I can talk about that's really amazing. I finally buckled down and built a Mister after we had Mike Micah on the podcast a few weeks ago, on the Tech Pod a few weeks ago.
I didn't know. So we have the same reason for having a Mister in our lives.
Look, Mike Micah is one of the great enablers in my life. He is able to encourage me to spend money on things that I don't need with reckless abandon. And then it turned out that I did very much need this. So the Mister, if you don't know it, is an FPGA-based hardware emulator for, it seems like, classic games up to maybe the original PlayStation. Eventually it seems like they're going to get there, but it's not entirely certain yet. And because it's hardware based, the games actually play exactly the same way that they did on the original hardware, but with the benefits of like low latency HDMI and Bluetooth controllers and things like that. So I finally set mine up last week, or week before last now, and this Father's Day I was sitting around playing Minish Cap, the Legend of Zelda Minish Cap, which is, I think, my favorite 2D Zelda game. And while my daughter was playing Minecraft on her Switch, and after about an hour of me playing, she was like, "Dad, could you make me a save on this?" And I was like, "Yes, wow. Got her." Yeah. Wow. So she's working on Minish Cap now, which is exciting.
Yeah, the thing that Mike was like selling me on was the sound accuracy. Yeah. And not just like the samples themselves or whatever that you want to call it, like the emulation of the old synthesis chips, but the actual sync between the video and the audio. Like if you play any emulator under the sun traditionally, you will have a gap between what you see on screen and what you hear, because that you always have to buffer that audio emulation. Yep. Whereas with the Mister, since it's a hardware accurate, you know, recreation of what the original machine was doing, it's like spot on. It's like frame correct, and it's all as low latency as possible. So it, like when you're running in Mario and you're holding down like, you know, sprint and you hit jump, like you jump at the right time. Like, and it just feels right. There's something that you almost can't, you know, describe with words, but it feels like it was supposed to.
Well, and like it's really apparent in stuff like Super, like Punch-Out for the NES, or Super Dodgeball, stuff like that. Games that are really relying on latency, on timing specific hits. Because like in those old games, you were playing on CRTs. They didn't build in latency, a lot of latency, like a squishiness on the inputs for latency. So like when you get to Mr. Sandman in Punch-Out on the NES Classic, I don't think I'm ever going to be able to beat it on the NES Classic. And when I got to it on the Mister, I breezed right through because I was able to see the timing, I was able to hear the cues, and I was able to do the dodges that I needed to do to avoid.
You still got it.
KO'd. Still got it, baby. Still got it.
On the software side, is it just running standard ROMs?
So,
yeah,
kind of. Yeah, ROMs.
You drop ROMs on there. There's a Linux like part that it actually runs Linux for a lot of the IO. Just handling of like your inputs and things, and there's also like a file system, but you just drop your ROMs on there, but everything else is FPGA cores.
I have it set up so the ROMs live on my NAS box, and it connects over the network to them, pulls them in, and then it was a really fun setup. After doing a bunch of really janky, working with a bunch of really raw open source projects like Home Assistant and stuff like that are still really in progress, it was lovely having something like the Mister that you just like follow the instructions and it works pretty much right out of the box. And then I've been designing a case for it, which we talked a little bit on Still Untitled, but I have a little bit of work to do before it's done. So I'll show you when we're
very
done,
cool.
Yeah.
Wow. Keeping busy. Anything else going on?
Oh, I just wanted to shout out Mouse Without Borders. If you have two computers on your desk, this is a Microsoft project that I think lives on GitHub actually, which still is kind of weird to me, like open source Microsoft tools.
Well, they own it, right?
Yeah, I know, but like basically it works like the old school Synergy app did, but it works really, really well. You can copy and paste things between computers, so it makes the two computers on your desk feel like a single multi-monitor computer. It's free, and like I said, it works super well. But
why do they have to be on the same desk?
Well, I mean, if you need to be able to see both monitors in order to use the same. The idea is to use one mouse and keyboard, the mouse and keyboard on your main computer.
Gotcha.
On your secondary computer instead of using like a hardware KVM or something like that.
So it's not like AirDrop for PCs.
No.
Are both cursors moving at the same time?
No. So when I move my cursor to the left side of my desk, my desktop, then it pops up on the separate computer that's on the left side monitor.
But just the cursor, not like, of course, Windows, because they're separate machines.
You can't move Windows, but you can copy and paste things between the two computers.
So it shares a clipboard.
You can copy. You can even do like files and stuff. So it's more robust than any of the software KVMs. I think it's probably Windows only, but I haven't looked. I know, it seems especially applicable now because I'm sure a lot of people are working with like a work computer and their personal computer on the same desktop, and it's nice to have things like not have to move. Have multiple keyboards and mice on your desk.
No, that's very cool. Hey, we started off with some Microsoft discussion.
There you go. You're welcome.
Okay. All right, then. Enough with the catch up. This is going to be a long podcast because there's so much to talk about. But let's get to, though, our, as I delay and delay and delay, as I cue up the music. Here it goes.
Top story this week.
All right. They did it. They went full arm.
I was right.
You were
right.
If you dig up this podcast from what, 5 years ago?
Oh, God. It was more than that. It was like 2012 when they announced the A4. I called it when they announced the iPhone 5 or 4S, I think.
Will's longstanding prediction that Apple would transition their desktop OS, desktop computers, to run on ARM architecture has come to fruition. All
it's
the
only
rumors
take
were
two
built
years.
Up. Yeah, so the details, of course, were unveiled at this past Monday's WWDC keynote, and we should talk about how the keynote went. This is their first virtual keynote. No stage, no audience. It was an infomercial for 2 hours.
Ugh.
Shot on the Apple campus, highly scripted, as their keynotes usually are, but also edited, not done actually live, which I think took the edge away from it a little bit.
Yeah, very different. I mean, you had people, I think you could tell that they weren't always the first take, you know, which you don't have that luxury when you're doing a live show.
Did they have any sick dad? This is usually where the dad jokes come out to shine at the WWDC keynote. Did they any dad jokes this year or not really?
There was one pun, I believe. One pandemic pun. But you know, other than that, there's so much other controversy going on in the Apple world that they chose to stay on message and not poke and not reference current events.
I thought it was cool. It was a chance for them to show off the campus, which is still relatively new, and most of us have no experience with any kind of, you know, tour of like where is the gym in relation to the auditorium. Like
always wanted to know.
Like I'm curious about that because it's an extraordinarily beautiful campus, and I would love to walk around there. But it's I had no idea they had a secret lab underneath the fountain. That's awesome.
I mean, was that really though? Was that real?
No. That was fake. That was fake.
Did they address the Hay stuff at all? The Basecamp / Hay.
No. That's what I meant by
okay.
Shit going on in their world that they obviously did not want to really talk about. Most of it was done in their big auditorium in the lobby with those big window panes. And was that display actually there?
I'm sure that display is there, but I wondered if the content was added in post or not. Like sometimes it looked like it was real, but
they did a very Mac thing, right? With the reflection of what was on screen being reflected on the floor, very much like what the dock used to do in Mac OS and in iOS, but I couldn't tell.
If there's anything that watching the gallery episodes about The Mandalorian has taught me, it's really hard to fake that kind of reflection.
Okay. So, okay. So Will's going, it was real.
Either that or they did a whole virtual set, virtual soundstage. They were just on a picture. They went down to L.A. and they were on the volume and they shot it there. That's my theory.
They could have very well could have, but it looked pretty good. I mean, from a visual, like from a cinematography standpoint, it looked well. It looked very shiny. It very infomercial like. I don't think Sam Mendes flew out to direct it, but you know, for 2 hours we got all the standard beats of an Apple keynote. And here's the big thing. Well, they started with iOS 14. You know, it is WWDC. This is when they preview what's coming out on iOS on iPhone and iPad, and some big changes. A visual, not quite overhaul, but functionally, we're getting widgets on iOS, home screen widgets, which look very much like the kind of framing of icons in folders, or when you swipe down, I guess, from the control center, the way that they're kind of grouped. So that you have these dynamically sized, you can move them, or user size widgets with dynamic information on them that'll show up on the iOS iPhone home screen. iPads already had kind of widgets on the left side, but those widgets are more akin to on the iPhone when you swipe to the right and see what's the left of the home screen.
How often did you use those widgets?
Never.
I mean,
yeah, me either.
I use one to see how charged the car is. That's the biggest use for me. Like, that's the most useful widget. I was more impressed when Apple got, for example, is the clock ever right on iOS?
Yeah. What are you talking about?
The icon clock is always right.
The icon, yeah. The icon is always shows the correct time with an animation. Like, yeah. That's more impressive to me than something that's essentially a windowed box with text on it for weather. Jeremy, you know what I'm talking about? If you look at the icon for a clock.
Dude, I know about the clock. Yeah. It's been.
That's like, what I want a widget to look like.
It's told the real time for ages now, but that is the size of an icon, and that's like a special icon. Yeah,
but
I don't
know. Enough pixel density. And I like the idea that these icons can look more alive and have real information because the icons are what we associate with the applications themselves.
Dude, you're right. I'm not terribly excited about the widgets, but maybe there'll be something interesting in there for me. I don't know. What I was struck by was how many of the things that are coming to iOS are basically lifted from Android.
And are ancient Android features. Like, widgets on the home screen is a, like, 2009 era Android feature, right?
Yeah, which for people like me who've never had an Android phone, they seem fresh. But I could imagine that you know, people who are Android users are just like, well, okay, nice playing catch up over there. But like the home screen widgets, this new view of all of your files, like I do use a Nexus from time to time. I know what that's about. It's like, it's a nice convenient way to see everything that's on the phone. And it's true. Like Craig, when he was describing this problem, like this is an issue. We have 10 pages of apps. I have no idea where anything is. And I always search for things, yeah. But it would be nice to be able to know where I can find them if I want to delete them.
I mean, they banked so hard on the spatial memory that people have with the relation to the apps. What they think of like, oh, this app is on the third page, top left corner, and people's muscle memory. But it's gotten to a point where there are so many of these applications you download that you use once or twice because they're associated with things like your router or things that, you know, everything, every piece of hardware, everything has, every service has an app associated. And it's just so cluttered these days in the iOS. And I don't think it was a problem that they anticipated and that they designed their OS around. It's how actually people have taken advantage of their lack of organization and organization ability on iOS.
You know what I want? I want a button that just lets me organize the icons by color automatically.
That would be really like a nice. Rainbow. Like, yeah, it would be nice.
I want like a gradient that starts with red and goes to purple. I feel like one of my friends at one point, I was at a bar or something, and I looked at their phone. I was like, "Holy shit, your icons are all organized by color. This is amazing. How did you do that?" He's like, "It took a really long time, and every time I get a new app, then it jacks up the whole thing."
That's right.
But yeah,
you know, like bookshelves, the same way. Like, you've seen people do that with their library. And mm-hmm. it's a wonderful approach, although it makes no contextual sense.
No organizational sense.
Well, but
actual supportability.
But, But like, if you remember, you remember the colors. Like, I remember colors of everything, even if I don't know what the icon on the app is supposed to represent. But I know that like Slack is a white background with a bunch of colors on it, and Google is a white background with a bunch of colors on it. And this is a bad example, but the point is, like, you know, if your brain works that way, more power to you, I guess.
And Reddit changing their icon to black really just messes things up for the whole month of June, right?
You should be using Apollo. That's the right answer to the Reddit problem. Then you can choose your own icon.
Another feature that they brought that I guess they also lifted from Android are app slices, app clips.
Yeah,
they spent so much on this, and it's the least interesting.
Oh, interesting. I like this. I think this sounds cool. Because this solves part of the problem of having 10 pages of apps, because you don't download that app. Like, it just, you use it temporarily, which is often what all you need an app to do.
Wait, what? Explain this feature. I wasn't paying attention.
So you can take a slice of your app, whatever app you've made for the App Store, you can take a slice of it as long as it remains under 10 megabytes. And it will be, when you scan a special code, like a QR looking code, or you have an NFC tag, it will download that app, you know, instantaneously, put it on the screen, allow you to interact, use sign in with Apple with it, use Apple Pay, and then you're done. Then it like goes away. It's a convenient way to like rent a scooter or rent, you know, do a quick interaction or purchase.
It's a localized web app, essentially. It's basically taking the web experience of a web form or menu or something that you would be using a website for, but then displaying it in the iOS proper format, because developers can consolidate and they can, like Jeremy described, take a piece of their existing full-blown app, but also have a way to get users, when they scan that new fancy circular QR code, to go either use the slice or get the full app later.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so the thing that was really interesting to me is that they seemed like they were giving more controls and notifications, which is like what I thought this slices thing was. Like the call notification, I saw images of the call notification application that gives you the buttons to press. So instead of like clicking from a modal into like the phone app, you can just pick up the phone straight from the notification and things like that. And it doesn't necessarily take over the whole screen, which seemed like a nice change. Like I can't count the number of times I picked up a phone call by accident because I was browsing through something or reading something and tapped where the pickup thing was just at the moment that the phone rang, and then I got treated to some call from somebody who was trying to get me to bail out their relatives in Nepal or something.
Yeah, they were real big on layering things, like the notifications, like you were saying, don't take over the window now. And you have picture in picture is now coming to iPhone. So you'll be able to continue to watch videos while you do anything and slide the panel around the screen, even slide it off, but still hear the audio. Yeah, it seems like they're doubling down on multitasking now that the processor is infinitely powerful.
I think that's really the thing here, is that they've reached the limits of like, they're no longer constrained by processor for needing to full screen dominant apps where other processes have to be halted. And so even things like making a phone call, they've allowed you to minimize that and have your phone calls not take up a full screen. Previously, of course, while you're on a phone call, you could, you know, browse and do other things, but all you get is that little bar at the top that, you know, you're on a call. Now it's like a small little window that you can tap mute and all the other functionality while you're then using other applications as well. They also have a haptics, or not haptics, but I guess more accelerometer gyro input, tapping the back of your phone. You can now program to do things like take screenshots.
That sounds like the Quest feature to turn on and off pass-through, which doesn't work consistently for me. It's not real reliable. I'll be curious to see how good this implementation is.
I think it's going to be machine learning based, right? They will need to make sure what's the difference between a light tap, a hard tap, because you can't necessarily, you don't want to have to train the user for that. You want whatever their fingers are going to, however they hold their phone, to be natural. But the phones are big enough now that a lot of people are holding it with that finger on the back. And so tapping to do things like access Siri, which is also now redesigned, is the thing.
The one that I thought was really interesting is the AirPods
We're not there. Okay. We're still on iOS 14.
Okay. It's gyroscope-based.
iOS 14, the most underrated feature, and no surprise that they hid this in just like a quick flash on the screen, you'll now be able to set your default email and web browsing apps.
Yeah, that is enough to keep me on iOS for another 10 years, probably.
That's probably antitrust related, like getting ahead of and the antitrust. But
I mean, look, you say that, but then they shut down email competitors 3 days before. So it's kind of, I don't know. It seems like their response to antitrust concerns is a little bit all over the place.
Will, what are your iOS email and browser apps?
So I literally just signed up for Hey last week. And
what is that?
Hey is a new email service, not a client, from the people who make Basecamp. So they've been doing like productivity tools for businesses for a long time. And it's like an allowed or disallowed list for email. So you get a list of all the people that email you. And it says, hey, how do you want to screen these? You know, do you want to see emails from Bob Jones's insurance agency who got your email address because somebody put it in the wrong way 3 years ago? Or do you want this to always go to the bin where you never see it? Or do you want it to go into a place where like transactional stuff like receipts and order tracking numbers and things like that go? Or do you want it to go in the list of things that are often interesting, but you like don't, but are not urgent, like mailing lists and newsletters and stuff like that? I found it to be incredibly useful so far. I forwarded all my Gmail stuff to it. They charge, like I've often said, I wish Google would just charge us for our services rather than charge us and run ads. And it's an ad-free email domain, email service that basically seems like they've rethought how people should use email, knowing what we know in the 21st century.
It sounds like you're taking advantage of Gmail's spam filtering. By forwarding your mail from Gmail to Hey, does Hey do its own decent spam filtering?
So it seems like they do spam filtering that's plus what Gmail is doing, because I'm seeing stuff that Gmail doesn't filter getting filtered by Hey. And then more for me, because I have a first name, last name email address, I get a lot of like people who don't know their email address or, you know, don't put in a generic email address because they don't want to be hassled when they sign up for a car insurance quote or something. And it lets me filter all that stuff out really effortlessly, which is nice.
Nice.
It's $100 a year, which seems like on one hand, it seems like a lot, but on the other hand, for something like if it saves me from missing one email that I would make money on, it pays for itself immediately. So, you know, it's anything that reduces the stress of, hey, I don't want to miss the important email in this deluge of nonsense is really good.
And of course, Hey is a company that has recent beef with Apple because Apple wants their cut in the subscription part of that service.
I mean, I assume you guys talked about this last week.
No.
Oh, I mean, it's their problem seems to be that they have that Apple has a triple standard on what they take their 30% cut from. So if you're a small company that sells a service, then it seems like Apple wants their 30%, but Apple also wants to have Netflix and Amazon and Kindle and Hulu and all those places online. So it gives them a different set of rules because they are reader apps for other services. And Hey was trying to, Basecamp was trying to do the, they were trying to say, hey, look, we want to be a reader app for email. And we're going to be like all these other email apps like Proton Mail and Fastmail and stuff like that. And Apple started apparently with them reinterpreting the way that they read those rules, and they called them on it. And I think they were probably right to. I think the idea that Apple gets 30% of all revenue that's generated on iPhones is a little bit inky in a world where 30 or 40% of the worldwide phone market is on Apple.
All right. Yeah. Other stuff. So let's talk about the ARM transition, because that's the big news, right? They are over 2 years moving to their own silicon across the entire Mac OS, or the Mac line.
And that means Mac Pros as well, right?
That means Mac Pros as well. And starting, the first hardware will pop out with their new A12Z Bionic chip by the end of this year, with the rumors being that it will be a MacBook 13 inch. Now, that means that they're still going to probably use Intel. They'll have a split hardware on the MacBook side, where you'll be able to buy presumably a MacBook Air that runs maybe an Intel processor, a MacBook Pro that runs the new A12Z, and then also the 16 inch MacBook. but yet to the user, the consumer, the shopper who walks into an Apple store or shops online, they will presumably have the exact same experience because they're going to run Big Sur, the new version of macOS.
I mean, I thought the new macOS was OS 10, OS 11, right? The ARM-based OS?
What do you mean?
Well, so they're calling the ARM version of OS 10 OS 11. And, I mean, how functionally identical is? Is it going to be the same OS? Are you going to be able to run Photoshop on the new ARM machines?
Yes. So what they announce is that for developers, they will have to recompile. They want to run native. Mm-hmm. So and they did the whole thing with every transition. It just requires a little bit of work. Microsoft's been doing it for a while. We've been working with them for Office because they know so many of their Mac MacBook users use Office. Adobe's doing it, and they demoed Photoshop, and it runs smoothly on A12 Bionic. No benchmarks, of course, in terms of what Premiere and things like that. All the native Mac applications, of course, are going to already run natively. They've been working on that for a while. And then they also have a new version of Rosetta, the translation software, so that when you install an existing application that's not compiled for ARM, an x86 application, at install, you can then get it to run. But maybe there will be a performance hit or an efficiency hit. That's just, we don't know yet until we see the hardware.
And they talked about Office, but not Adobe stuff, right?
No, they did talk about it. Both Adobe and Microsoft have these developer kits already, and they've been porting them over. According to Craig, it's only taken, it takes you a matter of days to get your code base transitioned into the new, probably more than that. But
I mean, look, my bet is with Adobe, when this happened last time, they had applications, some applications in the Adobe suite were ported immediately. So like Photoshop got ported really quickly, but things that require actual computation and the math is hard, like Media Encoder and After Effects and things like that took a while to port over.
Well, there's also a difference between porting and compatibility and also performance.
Right.
And optimization, and that's the big question. How long will it take for Adobe to optimize Premiere and Lightroom and After Effects for rendering and they've been working on ARM for a while on their iOS stuff, and presumably a lot of that code base will be shared.
Well, and for things like video encodes, it's going to be really interesting to see if their hardware accelerated video encodes have the same quality levels. Like if they're doing consumer level quality transcodes, then that's not going to work for people that are using Premiere to cut films and things like that. They're going to want higher quality CPU encodes. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all falls out.
So a big question answered is virtualization will be supported for Linux. And we were afraid that would not be. And with Rosetta, with the ability to essentially make apps compatible at install time or some stuff like JavaScript in real time, they demoed and they said performance is good, again, to be determined. And they did render or demo things like Maya, which had not been natively ported yet, as well as a game, Shadow of the Tomb Raider, running 1080 on the A12 processor. So...
I was surprised that we didn't see a demo of Windows virtualization because, I mean, they had even done this big, they've got Office up and running and we're big friends with Microsoft, remember?
That's a difference. There's no way. Yeah. I think Bootcamp is the thing that will go by the wayside and it will have to be third-party applications like Parallels that will get it to work.
But you were saying that you thought maybe that would not be allowed or maybe even possible. Yeah. But, given that there is this virtualization possibility for Linux, I thought that maybe they were using Parallels for that, were they not?
I'm not sure if it was Parallels, but it was essentially something like that.
Okay.
Did they, obviously Xcode will run on the ARM OS 10, OS 11.
Yeah.
Did they talk about Xcode on iPad OS?
In what respect?
Like, will there be a version of Xcode for iPad OS so you can make apps on the iPad instead of just having to buy a Mac to do that?
No. You make apps on the Mac.
It's at this point, it seems like such an arbitrary choice, given that there's, mouse and keyboard support on the iPad now, and it's the same processors,
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question.
I am reading now...
I made my own prediction a while back, which was that you'd be able to run iOS apps on macOS, and that is coming to fruition. I was correct about that.
That seems yeah.
So that leads me to think maybe touchscreen Macs later this year.
They are changing the visual interface in Big Sur, which like that's the big move to 11. Like across whatever macOS going forward, it will be 11 after this release. The icons, the visual changes do indicate that they are setting the stage for touch-friendly interface. People have now dug into the developer docs for Rosetta 2, and x86 instruction sets will not be supported for things like Parallels for that type of virtualization. Only the Linux application. So Bootcamp will not be part of Apple.
So they want developers to keep their dev environments on their Linux VMs, but they don't care about Windows VMs, which makes sense.
For the user side, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if they didn't support Linux VMs, they would lose a massive side of their web developer audience, because that's how most of those people work. What did they talk about the hardware changes in the Z series processors?
I mean, only in that it's going to be fast enough for desktops. The Mac Pro question is, that's the big outstanding question. I'm sure they have in their roadmap in 2 years something that will address that, and we'll have to just wait and see from the benchmark perspective. I'm really curious, hardware by the end of this year, if you're just, unless they come out with a MacBook Pro and say like the absolute benefits of this are like double the battery life of our Intel-based ones, of our traditional ones. That's what you sacrifice some compatibility or go through some of the frustrations of a user experience of having to do the Rosetta compatibility. But for a lot of people, who buy MacBook Pros or just MacBook Airs, they're not going to be those power users. They're just going to mostly use Safari and the native Apple programs, maybe something like Final Cut, you know, and GarageBand. But they'll want the advantages of ARM and longer battery life. And you know, there'll be a lot of information that will have to be shared with those consumers to make sure they're making the right decisions.
I mean, I'm sure they have data based on App Store and the analytics they get from OS X that shows that a certain percentage of MacBook Air customers literally only use apps from the App Store and web browsers, and that's it. And they're like, they know where they stand in relation to that. They're not going to make this decision if they think it's going to impact their business. I mean, on the other hand, it's the Mac business, so who cares? It's a small percentage compared to the iPhone business. So, you know,
chances. Your question about Mac Pros is interesting, because like all of their experience with their own chips for the past, 10 years they've been developing,
yeah,
has been towards efficiency and like power and, you know, and getting as much power as you can with as low amount of energy usage. And it's been perfect. That's what you need for the cell phone market and the iPad market. But now if you're moving them into PCs, like people want that, you're plugged in now. Like you have untapped resources when it comes to power usage. So now you can exponentially use more, but all of their engineering has not been around taking advantage of that. So I'll be curious to see how they transition to a more power hungry, you know, capable system. If all of their pathways have been towards a different type of efficiency. I mean, it'd be great
to get scaling, right? It's about having more of those chips, like as opposed to one of those chips that's power efficient. You can run, you know, or, you know, 6 or 8 cores. You can let's do 36 cores in a Mac Pro running their ARM chip. And let's have a form factor where heat dissipation is really optimized and it's not going to overheat like traditional, you know, like CPUs, server-side CPUs from Intel, because they are working on a smaller process. I mean, like all of those advantages, I think, are very Apple.
So the place that they have, the place that you're going to see an immediate advantage on these mobile machines is with GPU, because they can put, like, the Intel GPUs have lagged. It's obviously been a source of frustration for Apple for 10 years since they made the Intel switch almost. As GPU became more important for literally almost every aspect of computing, Intel has lagged performance, and now they're not going to suffer from those problems. They can choose what GPUs, what features they support. You know, if they want to do like a real high quality scaler, then they can, and they're not beholden to what Intel decides to put in their new CPUs. So I was a little surprised they didn't talk more about games, and they just showed a 4-year-old Tomb Raider running at 1080p. But I mean, I guess if you can do that on a laptop without the fans spinning like a jet engine, that sounds awesome to me.
part of me just hopes that they just stop trying to embrace games, because they've never been able to do it. Like, they've tried it time and again, and the App Store, they've shown what they can do there, and it's microtransaction based, you know, mini games. That's great. So that's their core competency. Let them do that on the phones, but leave games off the piece off their Macs, because they've just never done it right.
Well, there are plenty of people who are going to buy iMacs with family, and the kids are going to want to play Fortnite. I mean, as long as they do that baseline Minecraft Fortnite, that's all you need. This is not going to go after someone who wants to play things on the Steam store and buy a Mac for gaming. I think they've kind of given up on that, regardless of partnerships they've had with, you know, Unreal. And I think the GPU side, you're absolutely right, Will. Like, all their GPU options on the Mac side have felt like the last resort. Like, they hate Nvidia. They're never going to go back to Nvidia on their MacBooks. And the Radeon stuff seems, you know, they did update the Radeon chip on the MacBook 16 inch, but it's felt like, okay, because people still need to develop with better graphics, let's include that option. But if they could run their own graphics solution, they would.
Yeah.
Which they will.
All right. More news.
Yes. Okay. AirPods, Will. Tell me about why you're excited about the AirPod Pros.
I did not realize that there were gyroscopes in the AirPod Pros, but when you take two gyroscopes and put them a fixed distance apart, then you get all sorts of really interesting orientation information that might be applicable for things like, augmented reality or something like that. Who knows? We'll see.
Yeah, you know what's interesting is the engineer who actually did this part of the presentation, she used to work, I checked out her LinkedIn, she used to work for another company doing augmented reality.
What a weird coincidence.
Yeah.
So
it's almost like Apple
here
has hoovered up all the augmented reality people from the industry over the last 5 years.
The gyro is surprising, because we knew the AirPods had the accelerometers because of the tap, just like tapping the back of the phone. Mm-hmm. You tap the side of the AirPod for functionality. It's a natural part of the user experience for these type of wearables. But is there calibration that's required?
I would assume so.
Question, right? Because the fixed distance, everyone's head size is different. Ergonomics are different. What will that calibration be like? From a user experience, what they sold is sounds cool, and I do want to discuss whether it actually makes sense. So the idea is that when you have the AirPods on and this feature turned on, and it's paired with, for example, your iPad or your MacBook, which also has gyro information, right? Some type of 3DoF rotational information, can then triangulate and give the illusion that the sound is always coming from a fixed point in space.
So presumably the calibration is looking at the depth camera on the front of the device, right? Because then it can tell how wide your head is, basically, and do the triangulation math based on that information.
Really?
I don't think so.
You're giving them way too much credit for.
I think they're making certain assumptions based on where your head is facing most often. And then they'll probably look for changes, and they'll, you know, try to do micro adjustments and sensor fusion. But most of the time, you're going to be looking at that screen, so they can count on that as a baseline.
What can I ask a question? This is the thing that they talked about, the localizing the audio in 3D space in the real world is kind of neat. But like, when I'm wearing headphones, that is the last thing I want. Like, what? I wear headphones because I want to be enveloped by sound.
I want
not to have
sound there, not that I'm in a room with, you know, a four-piece quartet. Right?
No. But what they're doing is they're emulating a good home theater environment. Because if you are in your home theater, you have a 5.1 surround system, and you turn your head, suddenly the center channel is coming out of your left side, you know, aimed at your left side of your head more than it is the right side. And so they're doing is they're trying to emulate that using software and the gyros of the different devices, so that when you turn your head, they will, you know, accentuate or change the position of all of your 5.1 speakers.
So you're saying that the future of watching movies at home isn't setting up a bunch of giant speakers or a sound bar or something like that. It's all of us sitting on the couch with our AirPod Pros in a otherwise silent room watching TV projected directly into our retinas.
Yes.
Well, the noise cancellation will filter out the dystopia all around us.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Well, no, I don't think, hopefully, like, realistically speaking, I don't think anyone's going to be watching their movies at home this way, like, instead of, if they do have a home theater. But it makes a lot of sense if you're on an airplane. And I thought that it was cool that they brought up the use case of, you know, of being on an airplane and having the airplane bank, which traditionally has totally messed with VR headsets and fooled headsets into thinking that you're turning your head. Or if you're in a taxi cab, which you shouldn't wear VR headsets in taxi cabs, but they have solved that by keeping or watching that gyro of the device you're watching as well.
Yeah. Hmm. So does that mean that the MacBooks also have these same gyros that they'll coordinate with, not just your iPhones and iPads?
I would assume they all. I would at this point, everything has accelerometers because they want to be able to shut stuff off before an impact.
Right.
But I would assume that they have gyros too, because it's just built in. It comes free with the Bionic chip or whatever it's called, the arm, the eye chip. I can't remember.
And they know from a viewer perspective, yeah, home cinema is a subset of people who pay for, for a way for people to consume media. But the vast majority of media consumption overall happens on mobile devices, laptops, cell phones. If you look at the breakdowns on like YouTube channels, for example, it's mostly mobile these days. And so they know that. And so this is to augment that experience. And hopefully maybe it's a way that they can actually make the Apple TV Plus experience more compelling too, right? If they like, they've had a hard time trying to sell Apple TV Plus based on just content, but if Apple TV Plus is audio mixed in a way to optimize for AirPod Pros and HRTF head tracking, like that could make that experience audio wise different than watching Netflix on your phone.
Imagine the nightmare if this gets hacked, right? Like, if somebody can hack into your AirPod Pros and make you think you're hearing things coming from places that they don't otherwise exist. You know, like you walk into a store and it's like, hey, over here, Smith, come here. And yeah, like the AirPods guide you into the sale location. It's a nightmare. A
Hitchcock film waiting to happen.
Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking a new Matrix film. It's like Morpheus taps into my headset.
It's like Phone Booth, but you know, in your head. So,
And then they did talk about Apple TV Plus, or at least showed a new trailer for an upcoming piece of content. You know, I have been underwhelmed by my free subscription to Apple TV Plus. It's flipping that on, has done nothing for me.
I am underwhelmed with my free service.
I will not be re-subscribing next year. I maintain the best content Apple has produced is their 4K screensavers for Apple TV. As dinner entertainment over choosing something that they are putting on their Apple TV Plus service. But next year, yeah, that may change because the Isaac Asimov Foundation series is being adapted, and they showed the first making of trailer for that.
Have you read the Foundation books, Norm?
I have not, actually.
I
have always thought that those were completely unadaptable because they're nonsensical in the way that 50s and 60s sci-fi often is. Like, there's not through lines. There's like, I'm fascinated to see how they make a TV show out of this. I can't imagine it's going to be good.
Did you watch the trailer?
No. I'll go in cold.
It looks good.
I'm sure it's pretty.
You know, David S. Goyer is behind it, and he's produced a ton of stuff. And the cast seems good. Lee Pace. And they have the money. I'm going back to they can budget for a series that will span, you know, the many centuries that this story is being told over.
For what it's worth, I thought the alternate reality moon landing thing was pretty good.
Oh, For All Mankind.
For All Mankind. I thought it was okay. Like, it kind of falls apart toward the end, but the first five episodes are interesting.
Yeah. We're veering now into pop culture, so why don't we just jump into that segment? All right, a few things happening in the world of pop culture. Hey, we are 1 week away. Is that right?
It's been almost
1 week and a day away from the greatest musical experience of all time. No, not the Bare Naked Ladies. Will, it's Hamilton coming to Disney Plus.
Wow!
Trial subscriptions turned off. No freebies for you out there.
Sorry, chumps.
But Disney paid, what was it, like
80?
$50 million, $80 million?
Something like that.
Crazy amount to not put in theaters, but it will be out on Disney Plus next week. There's a trailer for it now. It gives you a sense of how it was shot, filmed over two performances a couple years ago before the original cast disbanded. And they also answered, Lin-Manuel Miranda answered a question that we had on this podcast, which was, what are they going to deal? How are they going to deal with the F-bombs?
I love that you're framing this as a question and not a debate, because I said for sure they would censor, and I was told no, they wouldn't dare censor this show.
I thought they wouldn't dare.
So Lin-Manuel Miranda on Twitter made the F-bomb PG, what is it, PG-13, you get one F-bomb rule?
That's right.
As if it's like a hard rule, when there have been tons of exceptions to that rule.
That's not true.
Yeah, there have.
No, like if you're thinking of like The Martian, like you can't hear it. He says it through glass in the vacuum of, well, not the vacuum, but through glass on the Martian surface.
I'll go look while you guys discuss.
My question is, why do they care what the MPAA thinks and how it's rated if it's not a theatrical release? Why can't Disney Plus have the full experience? And then if they decide to have a version for theatrical release and needs to be rated, then censor it there.
Who knows?
Because Disney Plus has, because the parental controls are pretty good on Disney Plus, and they would not let young children watch the musical about the adulterous relationship of Alexander Hamilton and dueling and all that stuff.
I
thought it was interesting that Lin, in that tweet that you mentioned, he said that there are three F-bombs in the show. Really, like technically speaking, there's only two, and they cut those two. And what they left was that was my wife, you decided to
right.
Which they never complete. There's no K on that, right?
Yeah, so yeah.
That's implied. The K is implied.
The K is implied. Yeah. But so maybe what Lin meant is, according to the MPAA, it would have been considered an F-bomb.
So of the other two that they dropped, he dropped the two F-bombs to make it PG-13. They record scratched one of them, and then was it a bleep for the other one?
I think it's a mute.
It's a mute. That's right. Yeah.
So I also thought that the F-bomb rule was that you couldn't use it to imply the physical act of coitus, which they are in that instance. It had to be an expletive, an exhortation, rather than the act of lovemaking. So,
then you're getting to the songwriting, because as it is uttered as an expletive by Hamilton, while it is the same word leading into the letter, right? I don't think the letter used the word.
Oh, interesting. That's right. Oh.
Reynolds, the letter from James Reynolds probably didn't use the F-bomb that way, but it's connected with modern parlance with his expletive in the moment in reading.
Yeah, exactly. Like Hamilton's in trouble, so he is now just experiencing like what you said. Yeah, That's the legal defense.
You know what it is?
Lawyer.
It's because Disney Plus doesn't have any R-rated content.
Right.
So if they didn't get a PG-13, they wouldn't be on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
Plus, now they can sell it twice. They can give it to Disney Plus, and then they can release it on Blu-ray and 4K UHD with the two fucks back, and they can call it the Hamilton 3 Fuck Edition.
Well, I'm sure there'll be like a Harmy cut or something that puts them back in.
Right, so
you'll be able to download that 50 gigabyte version with your two F-bombs replaced.
He gave up no fucks.
I would have left the Southern motherfucking Republicans one, I think, probably, because I think that's the best fuck in the play.
No. I think they made the right call, because this is the only one that rhymes. One that lyrically makes sense.
Well, I'm glad we settled the matter here. Very good. Looking forward to it. July 3rd, Disney Plus. Got to subscribe. No free trial period. Smartly, because they paid the $80 million for it.
It's 75.
$75 million. Sorry. It's still a lot of money.
It's just a good thing there wasn't a nipple in there, or else it would never have made it to Disney Plus.
Well, I mean, it was Broadway, right?
Yeah.
They could have done whatever.
It's nipples on Broadway.
You know what else is in there? Is something that's not on the soundtrack, is the scene where Hamilton finds out that Lawrence has died.
So yeah. I believe there are two spoken parts that are not in the soundtrack, and that is the longer of them. So if you haven't seen it live, it's a big part. It's a big deal. It's a very emotional scene, and I'm glad. And intermission too. There will be even a countdown for intermission.
That's
for
right.
A pee break.
You have a minute to pee.
I wonder if this will one day become an In the Heights style produced show, produced movie as well.
I'm sure. Like,
you think?
Absolutely.
Great.
I have no doubt.
It'd have to be 2.5 hours.
Yep.
I mean, look, there's an audience people will watch.
If you build it, they will come. That's what you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Got it. Okay, other news. Hey, some movie news, some Batman news. Now, this is going to be a long story getting to the point, but the DC Extended Universe, the DC world is fractured in more ways than one, but from a business standpoint, definitely not as cohesive and successful as what Disney has done with the Marvel Cinematic Universe. What Kevin Feige and Marvel Studios has done over the past 11 years of the MCU is something that's been unmatched and probably will not be duplicated again, at least in the near term, never say never, in Hollywood. $3 billion made for Endgame and hit after hit after hit with multiple directors and really building a universe of storytelling in 22 films now. Now, it's been imitated many times. You know, Universal tried to do their own big franchise with the Dark Monsters series, and that's kind of fallen by the wayside after the failure of The Mummy. And on the DC side, because they got superheroes as well, they tried to reverse engineer the MCU strategy by not doing independent films and single character films that build up and culminate to a big team up, a la The Avengers in 2012, but start with the big team up first. And that's why with Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice, they quickly put Batman and Superman together. That was the sequel to Man of Steel, as then a lead up to then Justice League. Now, Justice League famously failed. Many reasons for that, which we
talked about. It still made $1 billion, didn't it?
It did. No, it did not.
Oh, really?
$1 billion.
Well, and the Snyder Cut
will be its own thing. We've talked at length about that early 2021 to mid 2021 on HBO Max, if you have any inclination to watch that. But the whole plan, the architecture of this cinematic universe on the Time Warner DC side, which was supposed to be anchored by what Zack Snyder had created with the Justice League, is kind of in limbo, because while you have reboots on characters like in the Suicide Squad, which was David Ayer's first, and then now James Gunn doing the Suicide Squad as a reboot, but with the same actors, Margot Robbie, and then while very successful character franchises like Wonder Woman, Aquaman making $1 billion, being very successful on their own, there is no interest to bring back Ben Affleck's Batman. He's done, cape is hung up. Or Henry Cavill's Superman. There's no standalone Superman film in the works right now, though rumors are that Henry Cavill will come back as Superman as a cameo appearance in some future film.
So what's the news story here?
I'm getting there. I told you it's going to be long-winded.
I thought Norm was just enjoying recounting the trials and tribulations of the DC Extended Universe. Can we talk about the New 52? I think we're getting there.
Will Smith. That leaves characters like Shazam, who technically is in the DC Extended Universe, kind of in limbo. Shazam 2 still slated for release sometime. But the strategy on the DC Warner Brothers side is to let these characters stand on their own, tell good stories, kind of take whatever DNA and casting was left out of the DCEU and make omelets out of these broken eggs. And one of those broken eggs may be The Flash. So Ezra Miller, who first appeared in Justice League, was supposed to have his own spin-off movie, The Flash, and I think he's still attached. The director has left. They found a new director. But the rumor is that they're going to try to use The Flash as a way to combine and mend the fractured state of the DC universe. Because Matt Reeves has his Robert Pattinson Batman standalone movie. That's not Ben Affleck's Batman. That's going to be, I think, a younger Batman, more of like an origin story, his take on that. And The Flash may be tapping into the Flashpoint storyline. If you haven't heard of Flashpoint, it's a very well-beloved comic book storyline where The Flash, because he gets his power from the Speed Force and can not only run fast but also time travel, that Speed Force has also granted him from time to time the ability to jump between dimensions. And the multiverse is something that, while on the Marvel side they've tapped into lightly, and they alluded to what, like in Spider-Man Far From Home, the multiverse, what Mysterio claimed to be from, it's something that's at the heart of the DC. It's something they actually fundamentally use as a storytelling element to reboot the stories in the Golden Age, Silver Age, in the modern comic book story, and which could be very applicable to film stories as actors get replaced in these roles. As Batman has been played by, you know, half a dozen actors at this point.
Wait, They're not going to bring Michael Keaton back, are they?
So, the rumor over the weekend was that the Flashpoint storyline in comics, Flash goes and jumps in the comic books, if you haven't read it, Flash jumps, finds himself in a different Earth where he meets a Batman, and that Batman is not actually Bruce Wayne. That Batman is Thomas Wayne, Bruce Wayne's father. And that character of Thomas Wayne as Batman has become a beloved character in comics, kind of like how Miles Morales taking up the role of Spider-Man has become this a well-accepted Spider-Man. Thomas
except
Wayne,
for an old white guy.
Except for some old white dudes.
Okay.
But Thomas Wayne as Batman as a character, beloved by comics fans. And the rumor was that Jeffrey Dean Morgan, who played Bruce Wayne's father in a flashback in Batman v Superman, would come in to play Batman as Thomas Wayne in the Flashpoint movie. I think that'd be really cool. Jeffrey Dean Morgan, love him as an actor. He's done a great job on The Walking Dead as Negan. He's been the comedian, which is kind of like their dark take on a Batman character, you know, between him and Owlman in Watchmen. I thought that would have been neat. But I think that rumor has then fallen by the wayside just shortly after it came out, because Variety reported that in the works, in talks for multiple films, is Michael Keaton to return.
Get out!
As Batman to play a mentor role, much like Sam Jackson, and not only play a mentor role to the Flash for the Flash movie, but to tie in as the old Batman for multiple DC films over this next rebuilding of the DC.
Are they going to get Tim Burton back to direct this?
No. Tim Burton's not directing it. Now, they've already kind of laid the groundwork a little bit when Danny Elfman came in to bring back some of the original 1989 Batman score for Justice League. So it's all one universe.
Wait, you know, that's in there?
Yeah.
They play the themes. The score for Justice League is one of the good things about Justice League.
Wow.
Debatable, because the Hans Zimmer Junkie XL score was supposed to be really good too. And Danny Elfman was brought in by Joss Whedon to... And tonally, there's some stuff there. Some stuff that works. I do like the reusing of the I think he does bring in the John Williams Superman note as well.
Yeah.
But he totally has his Batman 1989 theme in there for Ben Affleck.
Compared to, say, the Avengers score, which is infinitely forgettable,
no.
I think they did a nice job with...
Alan Silvestri's Avengers score in Endgame.
Oh, I didn't say Endgame. Bum, I said the Avengers score.
Bum. Yeah. That's the one. He built. He lands that note. He earns that theme earns its place in cinema canon and history in the pantheon of great scores with Endgame.
Yeah, Iron Man's theme.
My 13-year-old refers to that Avengers score. I think that is this generation's Star Wars score. Like, yeah. I'm afraid so.
Bum 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 bum. Yeah, won't go there. So, Batman, Michael Keaton, I'm crossing fingers. I would love to see this happen. I thought he did a great job. Apparently, when he was filming Spider-Man Homecoming as the Vulture, he would go up to Tom Holland and whisper, "I'm Batman," while filming. So he definitely still owns that role. There's actually a great clip, I think a paparazzi clip of someone filming him like exiting a restaurant, and he says, "I'm Batman," and walks away. Yeah.
I would also take 2020 Val Kilmer to come back and play Batman.
Dear God.
Val Kilmer has gone through too much in his life.
He's seen a lot.
He survived like throat cancer. He's not looking good right now these days.
I could never get enough Michael Keaton. I always thought like he was one of my favorite actors when I was younger, and then he disappeared, and then he came back, and he's doing good stuff. So more of him, please. This sounds like good news.
I'm with you, Jeremy.
I want to believe the way he portrayed the actor in Birdman is how he goes about his life, where he just fantasizes about Batman around him all the time.
That's not a nice thing to say about Michael Keaton.
It's confidence. He can pull it off.
Okay.
Okay, we'll wrap up the pop culture segment. I have a recommendation. If you're looking for something lighthearted in these times, Netflix dropped a show last week called Floor is Lava.
You guys, it's a game show.
the game show. It's very evocative of the Nickelodeon family game shows, like Legends of the Hidden Temple. And it's hilarious. They've built out these essentially, it's escape rooms combined with Ninja Warrior style obstacle courses. Basically, these giant stages on this decked out themed pool with erupting lava and fog effects. Only three walls built because the fourth wall is filmed with a series of cameras. But these families and teams of three try to make their way from one side to the other through a series of escalating difficult obstacles.
It looks like people maybe get a little bit hurt playing this game.
It looks painful. People are jumping, like making these leaps and knocking their elbows. They're not wearing pads at all or helmets. And like shins are getting busted. One of my favorite parts of the editing, because they do this the same thing that like poker initiated back in the early thousands, which is the commentary happens after the fact, like the instant replays, like all the funny commentary. Like the whole thing is edited down. It's not live mixed or done in real time. But when someone falls into the lava, they never, obviously when filming, as they're filming, they pause the filming, they pull the person out of the liquid and they resume, right? But they never show that. That person is never seen again. They fall into the lava. It's like this 80,000 gallon pool. You see them like fall in and then they cut to like reaction shots and then that's it. And then they
go on.
Wait,
you think it's real lava, Norm? You think they're killing these people?
The way they've edited it makes it look like when your family member, your teammate falls into the lava abyss, they're gone. They're gone.
So here's the thing though. In real life, if you fall into lava, you're just going to burn on the top because you're less dense than the lava. Right?
You know the grass Tyson?
Yeah.
Yes.
So they need to make this like oobleck or something so that people are just like laying on the surface writhing and flailing around. Oh, it burns. It burns.
Yeah. If I was playing this game, I fell into lava, I'd do the Terminator thumbs up, slow. So yeah. Thumbs up, receding into the lava.
It's anyway. Like Family Feud, but with lava, basically, is what you're saying.
Can we talk about squadrons now?
Please.
let's first have an interstitial piece of music that I'm going to dig up right now.
Nailed it.
Nope, still didn't nail it. Here we go. This would have easily been the top story this week.
That's what I'm saying.
A giant, massive Apple event.
X-Wing's back, baby!
Star Wars Squadrons gameplay, five minutes of footage, and these in-depth interviews came out last week during EA Play, basically right after we recorded the podcast, and all our hopes are confirmed, our fears assuaged. I can't believe this is a $40 game. Let's talk about the nitty-gritty details. So single player plus multiplayer, 5v5, you play as a team of five pilots on either the Republic side or the Imperial side with different types of ships, five ships, I believe, five classes of ships.
Four ships.
Four classes of ships, that's right. And they went into detail of what each class does. So you got your X-Wings, your A-Wings, your Y-Wings, that's right? As well
God
as
damn it, Norm.
It's not the B wing.
I thought it was B. It's U wing.
U wing. That's right. The one from U wing is the support ship. And then on the Imperial side, your TIE fighter, your interceptor, your TIE bomber, and what's the last one? It escapes me at the moment. But here's the important thing: the entire game is playable from beginning to end in VR.
Ooh.
Full 3D modeled cockpit. You have the traditional X-Wing versus TIE fighter balance of weapons, shields, and engines. And what was made clear was that balance wasn't just about how much shield you get, but that maxing these out give you limited time of power-ups. And so there's a near infinite combination of maneuvers that you can do as you distribute the power, maxing out your weapons for double power or doing drift maneuvers, drifting in space, as well as an array of 7 power-up icons from a selection of, what, 30 that you can use to augment your ships to make it every loadout different. So a lot of customization.
And it's not just like the two sides are going to be different skins of each other. Like, none of the Imperial craft have shields, right? None of the TIE fighters do, which I guess is a part of the canon, which I didn't know. But it's so it's going to – I wonder if that side will be a little bit easier to fly in that case if you're only managing weapons and engines as your two sort of resources. I don't know, well, but I understand that the single player game will sort of take you through both paths and you'll go between the two. But then the multiplayer stuff is where I mean, we're all most excited about.
I'm really interested to see what, like, it almost seems like the single player is going to be like a Titanfall 1 type situation where it's like a single player campaign that's embedded in the multiplayer games. It's basically just teaching you how to play multiplayer, which I'm fine with.
Right.
And that the $40 price point lines up with that. I'm very excited about this.
Dude, me too. And it's like I haven't felt this way in a long time about any video game or movie. And I feel kind of like you guys, like talking to Norman and Kishore, who get so excited about Avengers movies and or Marvel things. And I feel like I kind of enjoy those as an observer, but this is the first time in a long time where I've been like so excited about something where it's almost like I feel childish, and it's like I can't wait to play this game because I want to believe that this is real. Like, I want to believe that I'm in an X-wing having a space battle with my friends against, you know, the TIE fighters or whatever. It's like I booted up my 46 and I loaded up X-wing for the first time in 30 years.
You still have a 486, Jeremy?
I do, and it's all set up. Like, I call it the computer museum, but it was one of those projects where, like, you set it up and then, okay, project's done, and you never go back and visit it again. But it's downstairs in my garage, and it worked, and I turned it on. By the way, it turns out video game design has come a long way since then. When it comes to onboarding and training the player, like, I think they expected you to read the manual back then and, like, have your keyboard keys all laid out in front of you. None of that is explained, but I simply cannot wait for this game. I'm ultimately excited for it.
It's going to be fully customizable for input as well, because a variety of HOTAS setups or, of course, playing with gamepad, cross-play across all the platforms, including VR. And there'll be a lot of, like, just looking at the HUD. You know, the cockpits themselves are interesting design. If you look at – there's a Twitter thread of all the – all the X-Wing interiors, because there is no canonical X-Wing interior. You have what was set dress for the films, but with every film where there was X-Wing cockpit shown, is kind of whatever the Greeblies, whatever the production design has put together. And so the video game designers, from the pilot's perspective, have had to invent a lot of that UI. And so you see a lot of that being inherited with the three power meters, with speed, power, and laser charge. That gets all displayed. You get your radar, your combat display. They did say there won't be any leading reticle, so combat isn't going to be easy. There will be a reticle, but you have to basically on the fly adjust how much you lead your blasters by.
They will change color.
Yeah, and they said it won't gimbal the cannons to aim for you, but they thought the leading reticle was turned off for the trailer footage. So you will potentially have a leading reticle.
There is
no actual off-center reticle that says move here to fire, but when you move your center reticle over where it thinks the enemy will be, spot. It will change the sweet spot. It will change color.
There will be gimbaled power-ups. Like, I don't know if you've looked at the array of things that you'll be able to upgrade your ship with, but it's massive. And a couple of those are like auto-firing cannons. So there will be some level of, you know, I don't know, I want to say like the engineer class, which is less of a, more of a, you know, more of a support role and maybe, you know, auto-firing weapons.
It's torpedoes, like, and their missiles. They're also, basically, you can stealth play. You can turn off your shield and fly under the radar,
coast. Yeah,
and sneak up on enemies. I don't know what the pace of these matches is going to be, because something we speculated last week was there going to be creep fodder, you know, filling up these space battles with enemy AI ships? And
seems
I don't
like
know
there has to be, right? I'm interested to see like what the game types are in multiplayer. Like, are they going to go for like a Counter-Strike thing where it's like rounds where you have one ship per round and you kind of are trying to kill as many creeps and as many of the other opponents as you can, or if it's objective based, or if it's like push the cart where you have to
push the cart and
transport or something like that. Like,
so they did say there'll be straight up dogfighting, deathmatch, okay. But their big mode is called Fleet Battles, and it's going to be push the cart. It's going to be your Nidhogg style. You start those five areas of the map, five zones, and you start the center zone, and you can choose to fall back or push forward, and you got to win three out of the five of the zones. It's not like you're going to go back and forth, but if you win three out of the five, then you win.
But those zones are super cool. It's not just like they're equal. They're just like in different places and they're the same kind of thing. Like you start with a dogfight in the center. And then if you win that, you move towards attacking their support ship. And then if you beat that, you move to attacking their capital ships. And
that's
so
there's
a real escalation involved. And the size of these capital ships looks incredible. I mean, to play this in VR in first person and flying along the deck of that Star Destroyer, hell yes.
Yeah, that's and this takes place after the second Death Star is blown up. Is that right? So probably no trench runs, no flying through the superstructures.
Yeah, yeah. And by the way, they've said zero in-app purchases. No, paid DLC is on the table right now. Even it's everything you can unlock in the game, you're unlocking by playing the game. And I get that this is a reaction to all the criticism that they received from Battlefront. And justifiably so, but I am so glad to see them doing it. That whether it was Disney's behest or not, thank God, because this is like not only a classic game from a gameplay standpoint. Here I am rebooting X-Wing, but it's a classic game from a transaction standpoint. Like I pay my $40, I get the whole game.
Did they say whether this is a Frostbite game? Is this the first Frostbite VR game?
I don't know if they said what engine.
It is the team that did Battlefront. It's the same team that did like the VR episode.
The space fights in Battlefront?
I was going to say the VR mission in Battlefront. Like there was that one thing that was, I think, in the Rogue One universe.
Yeah.
But it might be the, I think there's also some BioWare people working on it.
Interesting.
It's bold for them from a design perspective to force it first person, right? It's very easy if they were to, from the ground up, make a X-Wing vs. TIE Fighter game to say, hey, for consoles, third person, you get to see more of the action and you're feeling less claustrophobic, but they designed it from the ground up to be a first person experience, and that's what made it so compatible for VR.
They didn't have to make two different versions of the game. It just works.
Well, and like in more recent history than X-Wing, like the Rogue Squadron games sold reasonably well on small platforms when they released on the GameCube 10, 15 years ago, they sold really well. So it's a bold choice to go first person when those were all third person games that did well.
I'm hoping it's super successful and we do see a trench run DLC. I would gladly pay whatever they want to attack the Death Star, remake the original Vector Star Wars arcade games.
Oh my God.
Give it to me.
Honestly, I'm just stoked that they are making this kind of game again. Because like you said, Jeremy, the old ones are... I went through this where I went through and installed some mods and stuff to play TIE Fighter a couple years ago. And those games are hard to play and rough in ways that make them... That really don't respect your time in the way that kind of modern games do now.
Right.
Right. Like you'll play an hour long mission that has no checkpoints. And when you get 58 minutes in and blow up, then you have to start over at the beginning, which not a great experience.
So that comes out October 2nd and $40 pre-order now beyond all places where EA games are available. Including
well, and that's new too.
Steam.
Like
Steam.
Which will include Steam this time around. And the same day that they released this footage, they dropped a handful of their AAA titles on Steam. So they're back.
Titanfall 2's on Steam, baby.
Which doesn't run for me.
What?
I try to launch it, and maybe it's because I have dual monitors or some other reason, but it will not run full screen, period. It will only run windowed. If I try to run it full screen, it goes full screen for a moment and then minimizes.
Weird.
I have Googled, and I'm done. It is uninstalled.
Oh.
Oh, that's the best game of 2018, Jeremy. You're missing out.
Oh, it was on PS4. Or something. Yeah, it was on their free thing if you have PlayStation Plus, so I have it there.
Okay, a couple other bits of tech news in the video game world. Cyberpunk 2077 delayed till November 19th from its original September 17th release date, so 2 more months. I'm fine waiting for that. I mean, at this point, between now and the fall, it's Squadrons, and then I'm still excited to play Cyberpunk, but give it time to marinate and give it time for the developers to get it right.
You know, that November date seems way more like a new launch, console launch day than a September date does. I don't know about you guys, but
that's very, very interesting point.
Yeah.
Nice insight. Other things going away. Big news from Microsoft. Mixer. They're shutting down Mixer. They paid Ninja, rumored in the tens of millions of dollars, to be exclusive to Mixer, to leave Twitch. He took the money, kept the money, and now he's free to go back to Twitch.
Look, Ninja has a well-established relationship with Drake, who is now affiliated with Caffeine. And my bet is, look, the word on the street is that Ninja left Twitch in the dark of night without warning anybody that he was going, as opposed to some of the people who left afterwards who didn't kind of torch their Twitch bridges on the way out. It's going to be really interesting to see what happens with all this. The unfortunate
come back on Twitch.
I mean, look, he's going to go where he can make the most money. Whoever gives him the most money, that it's very clear that that's what the motivation is.
Well, he's already made the most money. He's made the money.
There's still more money to be made, Norm. There's an infinite supply of money for someone who is the best Fortnite streamer in the world. The real bummer about this whole thing is the way they announced this. People who'd worked on Mixer for the last 5 or 6 years found out, like, on the internet by looking at Twitter, the same way we all did. People who'd streamed on Mixer and built audiences and built communities there found out the same way that we did. And like the streams the day that they announced this were heartbreaking. There were a bunch of people who were profoundly upset, and this is the danger of building your audience on somebody else's platform. But when you're talking about game streaming, it's the only way to do that. So, it's an unfortunate situation. Hopefully those people land on Twitch or Facebook Gaming or YouTube or wherever streamed games are played.
We did our tank ball experiment on Mixer over at Other Ocean last year, that thing where we had four. How many tanks did we have? Like four tanks just playing soccer against one another? It was a blast live over the internet.
Good tech. I mean, it just didn't catch the same way that Twitch and you know, to be honest, none of the game streaming platforms, even YouTube, have done what Twitch has done. And that's the first mover advantage. It's one of those cases where being first and keeping that tech up and building those streamer relationships has worked really well. And the user behavior is really tough to change, even when you sign a deal to get the most popular streamer in the world.
So the bummer about all of this is that the technological advances that Mixer brought to game streaming, like incredibly low latency streaming and stuff like that, forced Twitch to catch up and chase. So because they're gone now, we're in a situation where there isn't, you know, somebody with a technological advantage pushing Twitch to innovate with things like the squad streams, where multiple people playing a multiplayer game could embed their videos in one stream that's playable on mobile and stuff like that, or the low latency streaming, or any number of other interesting things that Twitch copied from Mixer. So hopefully they're going to keep kind of pushing things forward. And, you know, even something as simple as bitrate, like on Mixer, you could stream at 10 kilobits per second so that your 1080p 60 streams look really nice. You can't do that on Twitch still. So
megabits per second.
Megabits.
Other things going away. Ninebot, which owns the Segway brand, has announced they've stopped manufacturing the Segway PT, the original Segway model. RIP.
So it's just the knee Segways now?
I think they're just doing the knee Segway, hoverboards, scooters. I mean, the dream of the Segway has been slowly dying, and the companies, I mean, I guess in the era of lockdown, the pandemic, you don't see Segway tours being a thing anymore. But they were still beloved by a small community of people, you know, like the Wazes of the world who do their Segway soccer and the tour groups.
Polo.
And Segway Polo, that's right. And
cops.
I'm sad to
Mall
see
cops
it go.
Love Segways.
I mean, thank you, Paul Blart, for ingraining that in popular culture. But what they didn't predict with the creation of the Segway was really electric scooters becoming the replacement, and the gyro technology, while being really interesting and novel and magical back then, not being necessary for the way we get around.
Or being integrated into a much more compact form factor, like the one wheel or something like that.
Right. Yeah. And maybe the whole rental scheme too. The way you mentioned electric scooters, it's also the way those have found success has not been through, you know, personal ownership, but through leaving them on the side of the street and renting them.
Yeah, and that's because those devices, along with the one wheel, they value efficiency in getting you to where you want to go rather than the leisure pace of the Segway, which was the whole promise that people wouldn't be walking anymore. They'd be just going on strolls on these gyro scooters. And
the mistake was they didn't make like a reclining bucket chair with the scooter attached so that you could just sit there and have your cupcake in a cup while you're coasting to work in the morning. That's the future.
I blame Job from Arrested Development.
you think George he Bush? Made Segways uncool?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. But I do love that his mom always called it a scooter.
I my dad, we went on the Pacifica Segway tour once, and he said, this tour guy was like, oh, you're the only person I've ever seen beef it on a Segway before. So congratulations, Dad.
Olympus also just announced they are exiting the camera business, looking to sell their camera business. They've made some great cameras with Micro Four Thirds sensors, beloved by a certain user base, but not sold well enough to continue all the R&D and support needed to maintain the business. And so they, while surviving the transition to digital cameras, have not endured. So RIP Olympus cameras. And then we got one bit of video game retro news, and that's Billy Mitchell back in the news again.
Oh, I love this guy. I love this guy. I swear to God, like I might go as him as Halloween this year. I just feel like, you know, if he's a villain, God bless him, because like he's done nothing really wrong. Like he's cheated maybe at a video game.
Fucking doubt that he cheated. Did you read what the Guinness people said when they reinstated him?
What did they say?
It read, okay, so here's what it says. After reviewing Billy's gameplay and reproducing similar games myself, I can honestly say that this is legitimate gameplay. Robbie Lakeman said in a statement shared by, I see no reason why Billy would need to even use MAME or save states to film both games in this style of play. Oh, wait, hold on. Eyewitness testimony, gameplay analysis, and hardware verification. Basically, Guinness said it's impossible for somebody to modify a Donkey Kong machine with other hardware, which is nonsense.
That is nonsense.
Yeah. And this whole thing read like, hey, Billy Mitchell threatened to sue us, the Guinness Book of World Records, and our lawyers said it's going to cost us a ton of money to fight this, so just give him his stupid record back so he doesn't sue us and we can all move on.
Print his picture in the book.
Yeah.
Print it in the book that no one really cares about. Give him the goddamn certificate.
Yeah. Like, none of this shit matters, nerds, is what I saw.
They're kind of right. You know, they're kind of right about that. I don't think that's the wrong call. I mean, this guy is, look at him. He's clearly evil, but he's evil on the level of, like, the worst thing he ever did was cheat at Pac-Man. So just like Donkey Kong or whatever. It's just like, I love it. And
don't besmirch his Pac-Man record. No. He's the gamer of the century because of that.
I know.
In the world of 2020, this is a low-grade villainy. I agree.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. I mean, although I have to say, when I see these statements, he's not wearing a mask. So maybe,
yeah.
Oh, Billy Mitchell.
Good old Billy Mitchell.
The saga continues.
I hope Steve Wiebe is doing all right out there somewhere. He's teaching class.
He is. And enough years have passed that students don't know about the film, and so it's always a pleasant surprise when the students, I think, discover who he is.
The
hot sauce king strikes again.
All right, our final segment.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
Okay, quite a bit here too. Let's start with the rumors. Bloomberg, Mark Gurman over Bloomberg, had this huge report about the secretive development of Apple's rumored AR headset, and with specifics now, the specifics being that they are planning a dual device strategy, that they would first plan on launching a VR slash AR headset that would not be the kind of wear out in the real world AR, you know, dream headset glasses, AR glasses that everyone wants to come out, or Apple thinks everyone wants to come out. But that would be the second device that would then piggyback off of development on that first device that would be used in the home for both VR and AR applications. I mean, the big news for us is that it means, if this is true, it means Apple is more serious about VR than we originally thought.
I mean, look, there's a stair-step path from VR to AR that makes a ton of sense. And if you, there's two hard problems. One is the latency and the timing and rendering for VR to be good and not make people sick and to be comfortable and fun and all that. And once you do that, layering that stuff on the real world with a display that's bright enough to be seen in the sun and all that is a challenge. Also, I would bet that Apple's market plans have changed a little bit, given that we're probably going to be cooped up inside for at least another year, maybe two. So, you know, it's not like you need AR headsets if you're not leaving the house. So,
well, the report here says that the first product, which would be more like an Oculus Quest style VR with pass-through AR, which I agree makes a lot more sense from a physics perspective and not having the lens problem solved today, or the ergonomics or the processing power solved today, that would still be for a 2022 release, 2 years from now. And the more interesting kind of reveal, if this is to be true from his report, is that there are lots of internal debate about not just the form factor, but about the basic powering of this headset. Will this be, will they design an AR headset where all the compute and power will be worn and local, like you have on the HoloLens? Will be something that they even mentioned powered from and running off of the processing from an iPhone. But, or what is new, the report that they had considered having a desktop hub that would do all the processing, that would then wirelessly, low latency, maybe over something like a 50 gigahertz signal, send visual data to what you would wear, which is apparently something they're not going with because Johnny Ive did not want that.
I'm the thing that I think is going to be the biggest hurdle for Apple is trying to compete with Oculus's complete distortion of what a product should cost. Because, you know, Oculus has basically put the Quest out there at the lowest possible margin. And that is not something Apple's accustomed to doing. I mean, if Apple were to sell the exact same hardware, it would probably be twice the price. And yep. And they have to be better. And so I'm wondering how the market will possibly adopt an Apple priced VR headset when even the Quest is having trouble getting, are they having trouble? That they certainly don't have the market share they want to have, even if they can't keep them in stock right now.
Yeah, they're selling headsets as fast as they can make them, but I mean, it's unclear what the current situation is doing to manufacturing capability in China.
Well, so. And also the marketplace and whether it can support development at a scale like Lone Echo or Half-Life Alyx, when you have a market size that's capped at a couple million rather than the tens of millions that you have on the console market, or, you know, hundreds of millions on the PC and billions on the mobile side. We did see Oculus, though, announce that they are sunsetting the Go. No 3DoF. This not surprising, and it makes sense for a lot of reasons from a user standpoint, but we are sad to see it leave.
Are we?
I think we are for a lot of, I mean, LBEs and a lot of places that relied on this cheap, good enough headset for a lot of experiences, whether for theme parks or for, you know, for just for media consumption. That vacuum will have to be filled by basically a lot of those, like, you know, Chinese companies and small companies making off the shelf commodity VR headset that you can sideload media onto.
I mean, look, I don't think any of us would have thought that the Go was a particularly good VR experience, right? It 3DoF is not great for anything that's 3D rendered, but it was great for laying in bed watching movies on Netflix, like a fancy personal screen. I don't the thing that I think Oculus internally was concerned about, and this was reflected in Carmack's tweet, is that, you know, not giving good 3D rendered VR experiences as people's first VR experiences probably did some damage to the overall perception of VR in the market, in the same way that the bad Gear VR experiences did, and the bad what was Google's thing, that not the Daydream, the one, the Cardboard,
right,
did. So I don't, I mean, look, it's bad to lose cheap VR headsets. The market will bring cheap VR headsets back as Quest, as they release new versions of Quest and run through old ones and stuff like that. I'm not, you know, rip go, I guess. I don't.
Yeah. Carmack has the most nostalgia, I think, or affinity for this platform. I think it was really his baby. And he did a postmortem for it at his last Oculus Quest, or his last Oculus Connect last year. When they just, you know, they announced that they'd be releasing all the Go titles on the Quest store. I think they must have known at that point that they were going to be sunsetting the product itself. And he mentioned in Twitter just this week after this announcement that the Go has never, no one has yet to really even fully tap the power of the Go. And I'm curious what he meant by that. Like if you felt like higher resolution video would have helped people's adoption, or what possibly could have been done to improve the perception of the Go. Certainly, I mean, the price point is the biggest selling point. $200.
He's a hacker, right? He wants to optimize. He loves the challenge of the constraint of the rendering power of the display, to do things like make video and stream at an incredibly high resolution. And you need development resources for that. He couldn't do it by himself, and it's unproven that that was a format that could sustain a marketplace.
Well,
and it's a subset of what the Quest can do.
Yeah, and if you compare and contrast that with like taking somebody and showing them Beat Saber or Pistol Whip or, you know, the Vader stuff on the Quest, like the reaction that people had when you show them, like you show a normal person who doesn't play video games Beat Saber and their mind is blown and they're really excited and they want to play more. I mean, there were some experiences on the Go, like the that were compelling and interesting, but not blow your mind. I can't stop playing this kind of experiences.
Right. Yep. Also, comfort, I think, is a huge factor. If you had anybody who's inexperienced with VR, they'd probably try to walk around with a Go on and instantly become nauseous, whereas the Quest avoided that.
I mean, just to be clear, the technical, I think the Go was by far the best 3DoF VR experience I ever had. And I think the technical challenges that they worked through on that, like on a piece of passively cooled phone hardware from 5 years ago, was amazing. Like, was it the right fit for the market? I don't know. I don't think so.
Stepping stone to 6DoF, I always said. But I loved it. I did. I loved the Go when it came out. It was great for that year transition.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of Oculus exclusives and content, they also announced that they acquired Ready at Dawn, the makers of the Lone Echo series. And it's bittersweet. I mean, I'm glad those guys are somewhere. And I don't think this is a case where, you know, the company is doing well enough where they could have just sustained on their own. It was more of probably Oculus coming in and saving the company, because it was a big development team and, you know, VR probably didn't grow as much as they all hoped with all that investment they had put in making these games.
Well, they could have gone on doing contracted games, you know, taking it one game at a time. I mean, that they did that with the three, well, probably, and they had Lone Echo 2 already in the works. Certainly that was already bought and paid for by Oculus. But, you know, from the Facebook's point of view, this makes perfect sense. Like if I worked at Facebook and I was given a blank check and told I could buy three game studios for the Oculus studios, I would have said, okay, give me the guys who made Beat Saber, give me the guys who made Asgard's Wrath, and give me the guys who made Lone Echo. And that's exactly what they did.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, Sanzaro, I forgot. The Oculus bought them as well. So, again, it's bittersweet. And also because they were making some of the best AAA desktop VR games. And if Oculus is going to spend a lot of money acquiring a studio, will they want to spend more money having those folks develop for the desktop platform rather than, we know they really want to push mobile experiences. And I think a lot of their design talent's gonna go to waste because they'll be constrained by processing and the capabilities of the mobile headset.
I don't know. They're already working on the next Quest internally. You know that their internal studios now are gonna be the first to have access to that. I'll bet they're very excited about whatever's on the horizon. I mean,
from a gameplay perspective, Untethered, absolutely. But visually,
no, I mean visually too. Like I think that the Quest version of Lone Echo is, or not a Lone Echo, Echo Arena is phenomenal. Like they did a great job of bringing the PC experience to mobile.
But that's Arena. That's an arena environment. It's not the vast space station and what Lone Echo 1 had and what presumably Lone Echo 2 will have in terms of a single player game. And I just don't want to see that go away. Like a game like Asgard's Wrath, like I don't see that on the Quest. And that's a game that I felt like was needed on the PC side.
Well, they have Link and certainly they're working internally. You can bet on it on a wireless Link solution. So I bet that distinction will only mean it'll be the same headset and you'll need a gaming PC in order to do the hardcore stuff.
Well, I mean, but the thing is, if you're building a game from scratch and you're designing it for Quest, that's an entirely different challenge than porting something like Asgard's Wrath over from PC to Quest. Like the things that you lose going to Quest, like the big thing is really dynamic lights. So if you're thinking about having a ton of dynamic lights in your game, you can't do that on mobile hardware because they can't do the lighting calculations fast enough. The rest of it is just art challenge. So like it's about scaling down the art, using, you know, simple tricks and nonsense to turn something that's relatively low poly to look like it's something that's high poly. And that's all doable. The challenge is the initial setup stuff. And also, like, you can't do a bazillion physics objects and you can't do a bunch of IK calculations and stuff like that on the mobile.
Which are things
hardware
that are really compelling in VR.
Dude, but the thing that I love about VR right now compared to iOS, what are we, 14? It's like, that is such a mature platform. Almost nothing gets me excited about what's coming on the next phones. But right now, like, the next Quest is going to be really exciting. Like,
undoubtedly.
Leaps and bounds. And so
I want to see those games. I want to see good developers work on those games. I just think it's going to come at a cost of...
But that's what makes it exciting.
PC-centric.
I mean, here's the thing, though. What I want out of the Quest more than faster hardware and is better sound and a more comfortable wearing experience. Like, I can't wear the Quest for more than about 45 minutes before I get a sore neck. And like, even with the Franken Quest, like, I want a comfortable headset that I can wear for multiple hours and has longer battery life. And I think I'd rather have that than the ability to do 4 dynamic lights instead of 2 dynamic lights at this point.
Hmm. Why not both?
I mean, both is ideal, yeah.
I want both. I mean, that's what I said. I said the next Quest should have 2 tiers. I want the like consumer tier and the pro tier.
Oh, God, don't do that.
You're
already going to have 2 tiers because you have the old Quest and the new Quest. You know, it's anyway.
I want the spare no expense. And obviously, like, I wouldn't want the developers to have to make 2 SKUs. I just think that everything that is in the pro version just makes the experience better.
Whether varifocal.
Yeah, maybe it's varifocal and maybe it's better audio or I don't know, something.
I can see that. If you want something that's better than a Quest, you should buy an Index, Jeremy. That's the solution.
Well done.
And a wireless solution for that whenever that comes out.
Has anybody made a wireless cable for the –
For what?
For the index, yeah.
Don't know. I don't know. That's a good. I don't have a problem so much with it. I mean, none of the games that I've played have. Yeah, I guess that there are the games that have most benefited from 6 DOF. You know, I say that. I was going to say like a Racket NX and certain games on and 360 Beat Saber are fantastic on Quest because it is wireless. But yeah. I would have loved to have played Half-Life 2 wireless. That's true. Or Half-Life Alyx.
Yeah.
We'll go through the rest of it relatively quickly. There have been rumors of Beat Saber multiplayer coming, and Beat Games, I think even before they were acquired by Oculus, had tweeted out that they were working on multiplayer. So if you're wondering, I'm hoping that multiplayer will come out or be announced at Oculus Connect 7.
Wait, why do you think this?
They tweeted it, that they were working on multiplayer.
What does that multiplayer Beat Saber look like?
That's the question. Good question.
What if it's like Tetris where you're slicing bricks and every time you slice get a streak going you send more crap to the other person?
Right,
that's what I want.
Back to back. I don't know. Right,
have you guys watched people who are really good at Beat Saber? It's incredible.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the same as the people who are good at Dance Dance Revolution. They have a dexterity and a nimbleness that I physically just don't have. And hand-eye coordination as well. Speaking of hands, virtual desktop gets hand tracking as a native feature. I don't think it's very useful.
Have you tried it?
No, but like knowing the hand tracking limitations on Quest right now, not for me.
Dude, the hand tracking is magic. I love the hand tracking on Quest.
Have you tried a virtual keyboard with hand tracking?
No, that's stupid. Nobody, exactly. Virtual keyboard's not going to work, right? Exactly. I just want to be able to do stuff with my hands. I love it. I think that is the coolest thing.
No, you should try it. I mean, I haven't tried it either, but I think it looks more compelling than you do, because it's meant for actual interaction with your desktop. Like, it's not meant to play Steam games necessarily, which is what I use virtual desktop for. But if you actually want to use your desktop, it actually makes a lot of sense. I love being able to launch apps without the controllers, number one. So that's good. But the other thing is, like, he figured out a way to select and double click, and like, it looks cool.
It's Minority Report.
The action gesture that's recognized, that's offered to developers by the API is so forced. It's not natural. I hate this tap to click thing that you use in the Oculus UI, and the occlusion has made it so it's just it and the latency too. It's a last resort interface for me right now rather than a primary interaction replacement.
You know what I want? I want finger guns and pistol whip.
Mm-hmm. Well, they won't recognize that as an actionable gesture.
You keep saying that like the developers couldn't figure it out. I bet the devs could potentially do. I think, in fact, that guy, Guy, did some things that Oculus doesn't necessarily enable with their SDK, API.
Sounds like his MO.
Did you see the side-loading thing that they announced yesterday?
Yeah, what do you make of that?
I think that's a really good – that is a direction that the closed platform Quest – that makes it incredibly difficult to sideload things for most people, it needs to do. I think it's a good move.
So Oculus has announced that they will have, like, they have famously curated the Quest store to a level that the Rift was never subject to. So if you want to make a game for Quest, you have to go through a bunch of hoops and you may not get approved. But they've announced that there will be a new section coming, I think, next year to the store that basically anybody can put their app on as long as they adhere to certain guidelines that Oculus provides. And you'll be able to, maybe it's a whitelist thing. They certainly make it sound like it's good for testing if you want to send apps to specific users.
Right. I think their approval process, the certification process, is very labor and time intensive, and developers complain about it a lot. And I bet it's expensive too. For them to run that on their own on the Oculus side.
It's also challenging for developers. You know, if you spend, if you're doing this like you would for an app store, and you spend 2 years building a game and you want to release it on Quest and they don't approve it at the end, then you've killed your company. So having easier alternate ways to release titles for Quest is a good thing, I think.
SideQuest is super in support of it too. Like the day that it was announced, they had a huge blog post. SideQuest is, I guess they're going to try to connect developers with the proper pathways to get on the store proper. The nice thing is you won't have to sideload anything. It just works in the store.
And I mean, it makes SideQuest easier to install too. It's good for SideQuest. Does SideQuest let you charge?
So they don't charge within SideQuest, but they will link to itch.io, where some people sell their games.
Okay.
Like To the Top, I think, is sold there.
Got it.
And then last bit of news, Steam VR has enabled a pass-through option, a reprojected view for the Valve Index. So you have this what's called Room View 3D.
Have you tried this?
I have not tried it yet.
Me neither.
But basically,
it did not work well in my room.
Pass-through plus for the Oculus, but full color RGB color with the cameras on the Valve Index. And it's supposed to warp the geometry to do basically real-time light photogrammetry of your room.
If you are a minimalist and don't have a lot of crap or wires or cameras or microphone boom arms or stuff like that in your room, it seems like it would work a lot better.
Yeah. And then lastly, this podcast is a little late today because, waited for a review embargo, Jeremy, you've been playing and completed the campaign for Phantom Covert Ops.
I played it on the Quest, yes. When did we learn about this game? I want to say like a year ago. It was
yeah.
you know, it's been in the works for a while, constantly, you know, teased that it would be coming soon throughout this entire year. Finally comes out, well, is out now on the Oculus Store on Rift and Quest. I played it native on Quest. It is basically, I think Dan Stapleton and I were chatting yesterday. He calls it a canoe murder simulator, right? I think it's really compelling game. Like, you're in a kayak. And you are in the kayak the whole game. Like, don't get confused that it's a shooter. You're going to get out of the kayak and walk around at any point in time. No, you are a kayaker, and that is how you move around in the game. And you are playing solo the entire game. But I would say it's about a 4-hour campaign. Maybe there's 8 different campaign missions. And I finished the campaign. And according to the game, I'd only completed less than 50% of the game, because there's a lot you can do besides the campaign. There's this whole section of challenges. I don't remember exactly how many, but there's quite a lot of them, 12, 16 challenges. As you play the campaign, you unlock them. And they are completely different gameplay sort of mechanics. And there's also Easter eggs to find throughout the game. If you find these radios and shoot them, you unlock these audio snips. So I think there's a lot of replayability. The basic gameplay of the campaign is you're in a kayak and you're playing stealth. It's nighttime. You're behind enemy lines and you're navigating through this basically like abandoned, sunken river, city.
Soviet base.
Yeah. Soviet base. And, you're trying to avoid detection. And so you're navigating into these reeds. You're staying in the shadows. There's always these guards walking past you on the shore or in patrol boats, shining their lights into the water. And if you fall into the light, they see you, and it's probably game over. However, you do have 3 different weapons on you. You have a silenced pistol, you have a sniper rifle, and you have a machine gun on your back. Of course, the machine gun is only if things go really bad. But it's
What happens if you need to do a murder on somebody who's not near a body of water?
You have a sniper rifle.
Okay.
And you actually, the scoring for the game is interesting, because if you do a murder on somebody and they're just a regular bad guy, it's actually points off, because you didn't need to do that if you play the game correctly. Hmm. There are bad guys with stars above your head. By the way, you have binoculars, so you can sort of scan the world. And if you look through these infrared binoculars, you can scan and you can see who are the high-value targets. Those guys you want to take out for your bonus points. But you want to do that so that they won't be seen. It's sort of like Hitman. So you want to wait for a point where they're not going to be seen by anybody else.
I was going to say, does this feel more like a Metal Gear or like a Hitman or like something else?
Metal Gear.
It's like Metal Gear, but I played it on the mid-level difficulty. And if I were to offer one piece of advice, it would be to play it on the hardest difficulty, because it was a bit too easy. You find yourself figuring out the mechanics of the game, and then you realize, okay, there's not much chance I'm going to be detected if I'm in the reeds or if I'm in a shadow. There's zero chance you'll be detected unless you do something stupid like shoot somebody. And then you're just trying to, you follow the patterns of the lights, and they all follow a pattern. You just wait for figure that out and then go. I will say that the locomotion mechanic is super good. Like, I know Norm got motion sick playing the early developer access a couple weeks ago, but I had no problem with it. They'd since you played it, they added a comfort option that might have been the trick. But basically, yeah, it's as you would expect, it's a rowing mechanic, but they do an excellent simulation of the way that oars actually work. And so you can backpedal, you can do a rudder steering technique where you like you paddle and then you hold your paddle back and then you steer. It's always this two-handed thing. And the Quest does a good job of maintaining, you know, tracking of your paddle, of your hand, even if it's kind of behind you.
Are there currents, Jeremy?
No, there's no currents.
Okay.
There's really no waves of any kind. And if I had like one request, like I wish that the game had more of that, it would be more of like variation.
A little barfier, I think.
I wanted more from the locomotion. I wanted more twists with the locomotion. Like, I wanted to be at some point pulled by something, or I wanted to go down like a slide or go over a waterfall or some kind of thing that was beyond what I got for the first mission. Once you play the first mission, you kind of get what you're going to get for the rest of the game. But it's like, I think it makes a lot of sense. It's a different kind of game. Like, if you're coming from a first person background, it's a different style of game, but I think one that really knows the limitations and strengths of VR.
Interesting. And this is an Metal Gear
plus yes, it is. Pirates of the Caribbean, the Disney ride, plus Metal Gear Solid.
Yeah, I get super. I mean, I'm definitely. I would give it a high recommendation.
It's a murder world.
It is one of the best, absolutely one of the best games on Quest right now.
All right, that's Phantom Covert Ops out right now, and that is also it for our podcast. I'm getting text messages about a poopy diaper. That
congratulations, Norm. Happy Father's Day.
Never ends.
Exactly. Maybe three today.
Look, you're halfway, probably a third of the way through the 5,000 diapers. So congratulations.
I don't know if I feel like it's a it's a lot of money also for diapers. Turns out diapers are very expensive.
Yeah.
Anyway,
just reusable ones.
No.
That's
no,
a nightmare. That's
we don't
a different
need that in our world.
Entirely.
No. Any shout outs, Will, Jeremy?
This week on the Tech Pod, we talked about our biggest tech unforced errors, the hardware we've destroyed. I told the story of evacuating the entire Brisbane future office when we were testing airflow through PC cases in like 2001. I don't know if you were still there for that, Jeremy.
Nope.
We talked about destroying hardware with unlabeled power supplies and all sorts of other good stuff. And I want your tech stories. You can find out more about that at techpod.content.town. Please send in your biggest mistakes, and we're going to do a roundup episode of those sometime in the future.
Very cool. Alrighty. Anything from you, Jeremy?
I just want to say hi to Kishore Hari, if he's out there listening. I hope your voice sounds better, and we would look forward to having you back next week. Thank you to Will for coming on the show in his stead.
Oh, absolutely. Shout out to Keish.
Thank you, Will, and thank you all out there for listening. We'll be back next week with another episode. We're running low on outro files, so we would love more submissions for that. But in the meantime, also submissions for new theme songs. Keep it under 15 seconds, please. And this outro comes from Justin, a.k.a. Speed.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
That's it.
Yeah, so those games that give those kids a false sense of achievement.
Yeah, and then I was like, you're not even drifted. let's get
That's it.
Alrighty. All right, thanks a lot. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye, guys.